discuss any of this further, so he decided not to ask her about Billy, who he was, and why Sally's mother had said that he was trouble and that he was harmless. That weekend, Mikey was outside helping his father wash the car when Corinne walked up the street carrying a bag from the 7-Eleven. She waved to Mikey and his father as she passed their home. It occurred to Mikey that their house was not on the way back from the 7-Eleven. Corinne had passed her own home up the block in order to reach theirs. She called out, "Hey, John, your kid tell you what a good driver I am?" She delivered this question almost like a taunt, each word barbed. Mikey felt his face immediately go hot with blood. He had not told his father about getting a ride with Corinne. She stood grinning with the plastic bag hooked through her elbow and swinging against her waist. She wore what looked like a very large men's work shirt over pink pajama pants and sneakers. Mikey's father didn't say anything, but he gazed briefly at Mikey, whose deep flush confirmed the story, then back toward Corinne, dipping his chin ever so slightly in lieu of a spoken thank you. When Corinne had passed, Mikey's father spoke to Mikey in a voice that was low and dangerous, like an idling motor. "Tell me what happened." Mikey told him everything, and at the end of his account, he added that Corinne had not once exceeded the speed limit on the drive over. His father wrung out the sponge in his hands. Soapy water plummeted to the paved driveway and landed with a singular and definitive splat. His father said with lips curled and mean, "I don't want you going into that house again." Mikey was hurt by the tone of his father's voice. He wanted to point out that Sally never invited him into her house, so he would have no reason to return anyway. He wanted to point out that it had all worked out just fine. He'd gotten to school on time without his father having to leave his workplace to drive him. And wasn't that a good thing? Couldn't they focus on that? He wanted to point out that Alice's big brother had driven Mikey to school several times, and his car smelled like what Alice said was a weed smell. Like actual drugs, and he went 50 in a 35. Mikey blinked rapidly to prevent tears from spilling over onto his cheeks. He hated himself for being so easily hurt by things he didn't understand. What a wimp. As Mikey reached for the chamois to start drying the windows of his father's car, he felt resentment ripple up through him, as black and dirty as tar. "Sally's mom is nicer than you," he thought scornfully toward his father. "I like her better." Mikey thought these words over and over, not just about his father, but at him, lobbing the words through the space between them like darts, and hoping that, even though he didn't dare speak these sentiments aloud, they would reach his father and hurt him bad. Chapter 11. It was rare that Mikey was truly angry at one of his friends, but not rare at all for some conflict to be smoldering between two of the others, with the most frequent clashes occurring between Sam and Alice. Sometimes it escalated to raised voices and name-calling, a slap or shove with no real intent of injury, angry tears scooped up by a shirt sleeve. Sometimes it culminated with a dare. Alice was the only one to ever spend the night alone at the Gunner house, and it was because Sam provoked her. They were all at the house together one evening, playing hearts and passing a bottle of pop-off around and around and around the circle. Alice was 14 years old. It was summertime. They had no school in the morning, so their parents were happy to have them out of the house and seldom took notice of their activities, unless they were out past 9 or 10. On this day, Babcia had offered the children half of a cheesecake, 2 poppy seed rolls, and a tray of spiced candies in tiny paper cups, which they had nearly finished. Their sugary fingers adhered to the playing cards. The windows were open, and there was a slight breeze that was not cool. A soupy dusk settled in, bathing the room in a soft submarine light. Alice was quite drunk. The subject of ghosts came up. Lynn had just watched The Shining for the first time. They continued to play cards as they discussed this movie and others featuring paranormal experiences. Alice announced that she didn't believe in ghosts and that horror movies bored her. It was Sam's turn to play a card. His blonde hair was darkened by sweat around his temples. He tossed a jack into the middle of the floor and said, "You know there's a ghost in this house, right?" Alice reached for the plastic bottle of Popoff and squeezed a small pinch into her mouth.
"I've seen it," Sam said. "A few times. So has Jimmy."
Alice spat vodka from her lips and laughed. Several others laughed, too, and Jimmy did not confirm or deny that he had seen the ghost.
Sally said, "What does it look like?"
"Hard to say," Sam said. "It's always in the shadows."
The others paused the game to stare at Sam in a way that annoyed Alice. She disliked it when anyone else took control of the room.
"Funny, funny, funny," Alice said. She played her ace and collected the pile of cards.
Sally started a fresh hand with a six of spades. She picked up the final candy and said, "Where'd you see it?"
"Upstairs," Sam said.
"I've seen it through the window before. That's where Jimmy saw it, too."
Sam was really pissing Alice off now.
"You're an ass-butt," she said.
She gripped the corner of her thumbnail between her teeth, ripped it off in a clean half-moon, tasted salt and something intensely bitter.
Mikey turned to Sam. "How many times have you seen it?"
"Oh, come on," Alice said. "He's just messing with you. Sam, quit messing with him."
Mikey said, "I'm just curious."
He chewed his bottom lip for a moment, then said softly, as though issuing an apology,
"I think maybe I've seen it too."
Alice tossed her head back, rolling her eyes. Since she felt the most protective of Mikey, it offended her the most when he defied her. Sally received the bottle of Popoff and sent it around to her left. Jimmy grabbed the bottle by its neck and said,
"It's true, you guys, the ghost is real. But I get the feeling it's scared of us."
He took a sip of vodka.
Sally said, "What if ghosts think they're the real ones and we're the dead ones? And that's why they're so scared of us."
Lynn said, "I wonder if the ghost is the one that used my hairbrush. I left it here one night, and the next day it was sitting at the wrong end of the room."
Alice made a talking puppet with her hand. "Blah, blah, blah," she said, her voice angrier and more percussive than she intended. "I suppose you've all seen the ghost, haven't you? Shared a beer with it, have you? Watched it take a shit?" Sally giggled, and this pleased Alice. Sam turned to Mikey and said,
"Three times. That's how many times I've seen it, and I can always tell when it's here."
"Is it here now?" Lynn asked.
Sam closed his eyes and held up a hand, demanding silence. Moments later, he opened his eyes and confirmed,
"Yes, it is here."
Jimmy nodded in agreement. Lynn made a small noise and captured her bottom lip under her teeth. Alice had lost complete control of this situation and was now very angry. She said, "Shut up, all of you, would you please?" It was unlike Jimmy to conspire against Alice with Sam this way, even though Jimmy and Sam were best friends. It occurred to Alice that while Sam was clearly just trying to provoke her, Jimmy might actually believe the ghost was real. Sam turned to Alice.
"Why don't you spend the night here by yourself if you don't believe it, if you're so brave?"
Sam was the only one in the group who ever challenged Alice outright when she was already mad, and even that was rare enough that it still caught her off guard.
"No problemo," Alice said.
"When will you do it?" Sam said.
I'll do it tonight if you're so worried about it.
A spider traversed the floor before Alice, and she flicked it with her index finger, really sent it soaring. Jimmy said to Sam, "Cool your jets, man. She doesn't have to do it." Then Jimmy looked at Alice. "You don't have to do it." Alice ignored him and turned to Sally.
"I'll tell my mom I'm going to be at your house," she said, "if anybody asks."
Sally nodded. It was a safe bet and had worked before. Alice's mother disliked Sally's mother. All of their mothers disliked Sally's mother, and would never seek her out to confirm the story.
"I'll go home right now, tell my mom I'm going over to your place, pack my bag, and spend the night here," Alice said.
"How will we know?" Sam said.
"Know what?"
"How will we know you spent a whole night, that you didn't just go home later?"
Alice scowled at him. "Whoever doesn't believe me can show up any time of the night. I'm going to lock the door to keep the raccoons out, but you can peek right in the window, see for yourselves, or give a knock. I'll stay until dawn, so if you don't believe me, come on down and pay me a visit."
She sent a mean look around the circle. Sam was grinning. He was pleased with himself. He had gotten under her skin, and he knew it. Alice shoved her middle finger up into the air between them. Then she screwed the cap back onto the bottle of pop-off and rolled it over toward one of the mattresses at the side of the room. She would save the rest of the liquor for later that night to put herself to sleep. The sound the plastic bottle made rolling gently across the hardwood floor was hollow and cool, like a conch to the ear. Alice returned to the Gunner house an hour or two later. The others had all gone home for the night. In her backpack, she had a Buffalo Bill's throw pillow, a sandwich, a flashlight, a Snickers bar, a disposable camera, a bottle of Coke, and the latest issue of Time magazine. She identified the least smelly mattress which she would sleep on. She paged through the magazine, ate the sandwich, and swallowed pop-off until she was nearly blind. Then she stumbled outside for a final pee. Back inside, Alice locked the front door with the deadbolt. It provided the only access to the house. The back door was fully boarded over. She lay down with the throw pillow at her cheek, her backpack on the ground next to her, and slept almost immediately. Alice woke to soft yellow sunlight through the east window and sat up on the mattress. She rubbed her eyes. She was parched and nauseous. She reached for the warm Coke and guzzled half the bottle. She stared around the room. That was nothing, she thought. I could do it for a week. That's what she would report to her chicken shit friends later. She threw the empty bottle of pop-off across the room so it plunked off the far wall, and this sound activated a terrible headache. She ate the Snickers bar. She stuffed the pillow into her backpack and went home, eager to report the experience to her friends. It was a success. They were all very impressed. Alice was the hero and the center of attention, and nobody said another word about that ghost. Several months later, when Alice had filled up her disposable camera, she dropped it off at the neighborhood Rite Aid where Lynn's mom worked. The film was packed with summer adventures, long days at Woodlawn Beach, Lynn's piano recital, backyard fires, Jimmy's infected toe, a baby goat at the Erie County Fair, an impressive stash of empty liquor bottles at the Gunner house. The next day, Alice paid for her developed photographs and took them home. She opened the pack in her room and leafed happily through the prints. Two-thirds of the way through the pack, Alice reached a photo that immediately sent ice whooshing through her. She stared at the photo. It was of her, sleeping on the mattress at the Gunner house, backpack unzipped and on the ground next to her, Buffalo Bill's throw pillow at her cheek, hands clasped at her chin, flash activated so that her white body shone. Her chest tightened and went hot with the effort of not screaming. Her heart slammed out of her ears. She stared at the photo of her sleeping self and felt the urge to vomit, so she ran to the bathroom and was unable to empty herself. But she heaved and coughed until her throat roared with pain. Sally's words about ghosts from months earlier sprang fresh to Alice's mind now. What if ghosts think they're the real ones, and we're the dead ones? Then she thought of something Lynn had said years ago, the first time they had played blackout. Alice had never forgotten the moment when Lynn woke from her dream and said, "It was like I was alive then, and I'm dead now." Alice's chin was still bobbing just above the toilet bowl as she thought about the way her pale body looked in that photo. Wan, corpse-like. And she considered the possibility that she was not alive and not real. She considered the possibility that somehow all of her friends had already discovered this. She was the last to know and the butt of the joke. The dead girl who still thought she was alive.
Chapter 12. Jimmy was right about the driveway at the lake house. It was a steep and treacherous descent, and Mikey would have driven right past it had he not been advised to watch closely after crossing the train tracks. The house could not be seen from the road. Once he had made his way back, Mikey could see that several vehicles were already parked and a clear path had been shoveled to the door. The house was a massive and gorgeous timber A-frame. It looked magical and luminous, with tiny gold lights twinkling along the trim, smoke rising from the chimney, the frozen-over lake visible just beyond a large patio area that had already been cleared of snow. Mikey judged that the nearest houses were at least a quarter mile away in each direction. It was a sizable plot, and utterly enchanting. He got out of his car as Alice was parking her Jeep next to him. He pulled a tray of croissants from his back seat. He had baked these that morning for the group. For some reason, the croissants seemed stupid now. He decided to bring them in anyway, recalling Alice's hunger and not knowing if there would be anything to snack on before dinner. Alice got out of her car, looking perturbed, her phone at her ear.
"You said a lake cottage, Jimmy," she said into the phone. "Not the freaking Taj Mahal."
She was quiet for a bit and rolled her eyes at Mikey.
"If you say so," she said into the phone. "Safe flight. Right. I'm just saying. Yes, of course he's potty trained, you dingus, but he's a dog, Jimmy. He's got fur. He's 100 years old. He has accidents."
"Okay."
Alice hung up her phone and said, "He's insisting we let Finn in, even though this place is..." She lifted an arm and did a broad and grandiose gesture toward the house. "This kind of place." Chris opened the door of the back seat, and she gently helped a large old husky out into the snow. Finn had one blue eye and one black eye, both of them watery and low-lidded, and a mottled tongue, long and limp as a noodle. He was mostly gray with a few black and caramel patches. His fur looked a few sizes too large for his frame, and he seemed uncertain on his thin legs in the deep snow. Mikey ran a knuckle over Finn's skull, and Finn leaned his head up at a sharper tilt.
"Good old boy," Mikey said. "Good old boy."
"Not that old," Alice said. "Give the guy a complex."
Chris said, "My mom has a chihuahua so old it has no teeth left, and she has to feed it through a squeezy tube like Go-Gurt." Mikey laughed, and Chris did not. A distant train whistle sounded, howling mournfully over the snowy landscape. Alice, Chris, Mikey, and Finn entered the home through a side door that opened directly to the kitchen, where they were greeted by several caterers who were scuttling between hot pans and cutting boards. It smelled magnificent. Meat and rosemary and garlic and sweet balsamic. One of the caterers introduced herself and pointed them toward the bar. "Jimmy said to help yourselves to everything," she said. Mikey thanked her and hung his coat.
Alice shook snow out of her dark hair and looked around the room and said, "Good God!" Alice was wearing men's work boots, and she knelt now to unlace them. She took off her fleece vest and used it as a rag to remove snow and mud from Finn's paws. Chris's scarf was wrapped as elaborately as a turban, and she unfurled it, then unzipped and removed her stylish black coat and black boots. Under all that black leather, she wore an eggplant-colored sweater over skin-tight dark jeans. They walked from the kitchen through the dining room, where a glass table was already elegantly set for seven, then out into the main room, which was massive and had floor-to-ceiling glass windows facing the lake. A gorgeous baby grand piano gleamed on the far side of the room, and several cream-colored leather couches surrounded a mahogany coffee table. Chris went to the piano and ran her finger over the keys, the whole way from bottom to top, then top to bottom, ending on a resonant bass note. Alice went to the bar, grabbed a bottle of wine without reading its label, and used a corkscrew attached to her keychain to open it. She brought this and three glasses to the coffee table in the main room. Mikey set the croissants there as well. Alice poured three generous glasses, then stared at the bottle. "French," she said. She spun the glass with faux expertise, then lowered her face deep into the glass to sniff the wine. "It's got a French stench," she said. She picked up a croissant and bit into the corner. She chewed rapidly, and buttery flakes adhered to her lips and chin. She gazed at Mikey for a moment, then said, "Please take off your tie."
"Why?"
"I've never seen you in a tie. It's making me nervous." Mikey loosened and undid his tie. He draped it over the back of the couch. Chris said,
"Babe, I'm gonna go pick us out a bedroom, drop our bags off. Something on the lakeside, maybe? Then I'm gonna hop in the shower. I could use a freshen up."
She took her wine with her as she went to select a room. Alice settled in next to Mikey on the couch and took a large swallow of wine. She said, "That service just about did me in.
What a mess.
Sally, old Sally.
I just can't believe it. I won't.
Skyway. Somebody a few years older than us offed themselves there too, didn't they? Not long after we started high school. You remember that?"
Mikey nodded. "There have been plenty of others too. They've been talking about installing netting for years."
"Well, why the hell don't they? How many people are going to have to throw themselves off the damn thing before they do?"
Alice stared angrily out the window at the lake. She ate more of her croissant.
Mikey said, "How many suicides do you think you actually prevent with a thing like that?"
"I see your point," Alice said. "Person who wants to stop living is going to find a way."
She paused and shivered, gripping her own elbows.
Then she said, "This will turn me into a sad sack starting out the night this way. Tell me about your life, Mikey, would you? What's new? You ever get that sourdough to turn out?"
Mikey was frankly shocked that Alice remembered this. He had mentioned his sourdough starter only once in an email several months earlier. He said, "I did, actually. Trial and error, but I ended up with one perfect loaf."
"What'd you do with it?" Alice asked.
"Ate it."
"How?"
"One slice at a time."
"Ha ha, funny asshole. I mean, with what? And with whom?"
"I had some leftover pork shoulder. Open-faced sandwiches with raspberry cinnamon jam. All by my lonesome."
"Sounds like a hell of a meal to eat all by your lonesome."
"My cat was around." Mikey sipped his wine. "So, how long have you and Christine been together?"
6 months, Alice said.
She leaned a little bit closer.
6 long months, she whispered.
"Why is that?"
"She's a millennial, Mikey.
Do you know any?"
"What are we?"
"We're Gen Xers."
"What's the difference?"
"Millennials take themselves very seriously."
"Oh?"
"She fancies herself an artiste."
Alice said this with a flip of her wrist.
"They all do."
"She's not?"
"You're not on Instagram, Mikey. You wouldn't understand."
He laughed. So why are you still together?
Alice shrugged mildly.
We have some good fun. Dating a young, hot person is good for my self-esteem, and I think she thinks I'm novel.
You are novel, Mikey said.
Am I?
Alice sipped her wine. Mikey nodded.
Charismatic. Disturbing.
Chris was at the stairs behind them, and she called.
Babe, I put us in the master. Up the stairs, second door on your left.
Alice gave an A-OK sign with her fingers over her shoulder, without turning around. Finn settled himself at Alice's feet in a slow and careful maneuver that looked painful. Alice nuzzled him with her toes. She said to Finn, I love you, old man. She looked up to Mikey. Did you ever talk to Sally over the years? Mikey shook his head. We passed now and then on the street, in a store. Nothing ever changed. Alice took another large swallow of wine and leaned back into the couch.
You know, I never wanted to bring Sally up with you or the others because it was so...
She paused, fidgeting, and reached down to touch Finn's head again, an involuntary comfort measure she seemed to require.
I wanted to ask you a million times over the years if you ever saw her, how she seemed, but it never came up. I never stopped wondering, though. Never stopped wanting to ask.
I wouldn't have had any answers for you anyhow, Mikey hesitated, then said. Do you think there's a chance Lynn or Sam or Jimmy knows more than we do? Why she left us the first time?
Alice cracked her neck.
Do you think Jimmy's flight was really delayed or he's avoiding us?
Maybe it's all his fault.
Everything's Jimmy's fault. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. In fact, he probably lured us all here to kill us and eat us up.
Mikey laughed.
Alice said, I'm just bitter because I'm jealous of the guy.
I mean, look around.
Alice gestured dramatically toward their surroundings, the immaculately furnished room, the spectacular view of the frozen lake before them.
Rich bastard.
Chapter 13. In the fourth grade, while Jimmy's classmates were struggling through multiplication of fractions, he discovered he was able to complete in half a minute a worksheet that took everyone else the entire class period. Jimmy's teacher, Mrs. Perry, took notice and kept him after class to discuss this. She asked if he was being tutored at home, he was not, and what his parents did for a living. His mother worked as a line cook at Mulberry's, and his father drove trucks. She then asked if Jimmy would be interested in moving ahead with new lessons once or twice a week, one-on-one with her, definitely in math and potentially other subjects too, and if, down the line, he would consider joining the class that was a year or two ahead of his own. Jimmy said yes to the one-on-one lessons and no to skipping a grade. He didn't want to be separated from the gunners in his class, and he definitely didn't want the attention associated with moving ahead of his classmates in school. Jimmy already stood out more than he would have liked as the only Italian on a street full of Polish and Irish kids. Jimmy's parents were both first generation, and sometimes the gunners liked to stand at the windows of Jimmy's house and listen to his parents rant and gossip and sing in Italian. Then they would imitate them later in great lilting melodies, and although Jimmy knew this was not mean-spirited, the attention embarrassed him. It made him conscious of the difference between his parents and the other parents. Jimmy kept his thick black hair buzzed to an eighth of an inch against his scalp. He pronounced his very Italian last name in the most American way possible, and although his first name was Vincenzo, he introduced himself to everyone as Jimmy. The gunners received news of Jimmy's math lessons surprisingly well. He kept it hidden as long as he could, but eventually ran out of excuses for his after-school meetings with Mrs. Perry. He stared intently at his Adidas soccer shoes, a half-size too small and very narrow in the toe, as he delivered the information to the others that he was sort of smart, and Mrs. Perry was sort of trying to advance him. Sam was the first to respond.
Does this mean you'll do our homework for us? Say yes, say yes.
Lynn said, say yes, say yes. Alice chimed in, how long does it take for you to do one of them worksheets?
A minute or two, Jimmy confessed. Sometimes less.
Holy crow! That is really fast! Jimmy took on homework duty for the gunners. He would stand over their shoulders in the evenings when they brought their assignments to the gunner house and dictate answers for them to enter in their own handwriting. On top of this, Jimmy created an elaborate cheating scheme for classroom tests by devising a numerical version of Morse code that allowed him to communicate with others in his classroom by rapping his pen against his desk to signify answers. It was a complicated code, though, and Sally was the only one who took the time to learn it. Jimmy devoured algebra with Mrs. Perry, and then moved into pre-calculus with a different teacher. Mrs. Perry was always badgering Jimmy to set up a meeting with his parents, and she reached out to them directly a few times, but they both worked full-time and spoke poor English. His parents could never make the meetings at school or even carve out the time for a proper phone call. By the end of Jimmy's seventh grade year, he was doing college-level math coursework. One afternoon, when Jimmy was 13, his after-school advanced theory class went long, and he was late arriving at the gunner house. Alice said, "So what are they teaching you in your fancy classes anyway? How to turn water into wine? How to make your shit not stink?" Jimmy laughed. "We talked about paradoxes today."
"Para what?"
"It's like a statement that's logical, but contradicts itself in some way." Sally was combing through her hair with her fingers. She said, "So it's both right and wrong at the same time?"
"Sort of."
Alice said, "Say one." Jimmy said, "Okay. There's a crocodile who has taken a mom's kid. The crocodile tells the mom, 'I'll give you back your kid if you correctly predict whether or not I give your kid back.' So what happens if the mom says, 'I predict you will not give my kid back?'" Sam blinked at him.
"Then the crocodile eats the kid, duh."
Alice said, "But the crocodile just said he'll give it back if she guesses right, you dummy."
"Okay," Sam frowned. "So then the crocodile gives the kid back."
Jimmy said, "But then he's violating his own terms, because the mom's prediction was wrong. See, there's no logical solution. That's what a paradox is."
Sam said, "I hate this."
Sally said, "Tell us another one."
Jimmy said, "Okay.
The Abilene paradox has to do with group behavior. It's when everyone tries so hard to accommodate everyone else that no one ends up getting what they want." Alice said, "Explain." You have this family sitting around. The dad says, "Should we go to Abilene for dinner?" "What's Abilene?" "It's a city in Texas, but that's beside the point." Alice said, "Why in God's name would anyone want to go to Texas? Bunch of dog diddlers."
Mikey said, "What's that?"
"Somebody who diddles dogs," Alice said. "You know, like..." She screwed one finger into her other closed fist. Lynn cried, "Gross!"
"Hold up," Jimmy said.
"So the mom says, 'Sure, that sounds like a nice idea, doesn't it?' And she looks at the son, who says, 'Sure.' And the sister says, 'Sure, that sounds nice.' So they go to Abilene for dinner. Then they get back home and somebody says, 'That wasn't fun. I would have preferred to stay home.' Then they look around and realize that all four of them would have preferred to stay home. So then they can't figure out why they went on a trip that no one wanted to go on."
"So why did they?" Sally said.
Sam said miserably,
"I don't get this."
Lynn snapped, "What's the point of this?"
Lynn's moods were confounding these days. At any given moment, she could go from grouchy and distracted to giddy and overly emotive to stormy and subdued with no warning and for no apparent reason.
Sally said,
I want to understand.
Jimmy explained, "The paradox is that because people want to do what the group wants to do, they might act against what they want individually. But if every single person is doing that, no one is getting what they want."
It was quiet for a bit.
Sally said, "Are we like this?" Mikey asked her what she meant. Sally said, "Do we ever do things we don't really want to do?" Alice said, "Well, I know I don't. I make sure at least one of us is getting what she wants." Sally laughed.
"Tell us one more, Jimmy."
"The service recovery paradox," Jimmy said.
"What does it mean?"
"It means a customer is likely to have a higher opinion of a company after the company corrects a bad service than if there was no problem in the first place." Lynn said, "You mean people think something's better if it's fixed than if there was never anything wrong?" Jimmy nodded. Sam whined. "Can we please play cards now? This isn't even math." Lynn said, "Is there any of that Glenn's left?"
"The vodka from the other night?" Alice said. "No, we finished that over the weekend. Don't you remember?"
Sam said, "My Uncle Randy's coming tomorrow. He usually brings over like 3 cases of beer and a ham and these cleaning supplies he tries to sell to my mom, and he sticks around for about a week. I can probably snag a few of his beers."
Alice said, "My brother's dating some girl who's in college. She has those mutant kind of thumbs, and I don't like her, but I'll be real nice and ask her if she'll buy something. We'll have to give her money, though."
Sally said, "What if the mom predicts that the crocodile will give her kid back?" They all looked at her.
"What?"
"If the mom predicts that he'll give the kid back, then the crocodile has to give the kid back, right?"
"No," Alice said, her face lighting up as she understood. "Remember, he only has to give it back if the mom guesses right. So if she says he's going to give it back, he can still eat the kid without breaking his promise. It works either way."
Jimmy nodded. He turned to Sally. "Do you get it?" Sally nodded.
"Okay."
As the deck of cards was retrieved and conversation strayed to other topics, Jimmy noticed that Sally seemed to linger on her thoughts. Jimmy knew Sally and Sally's secrets well enough to imagine what she was thinking about. He wanted to take Sally's hand, but he didn't dare offer this gesture in front of the group. What the two of them shared could not be made known to the others. Still, he was pleased that she liked his paradoxes. He would tell her more later that night, when it was just the two of them. Since Sam struggled the most in school out of all of them, Jimmy was puzzled when, in early spring of their junior year of high school, Sam suddenly refused Jimmy's help. Sam stopped bringing his homework over to the Gunner house. He laughed less at Jimmy's jokes and wouldn't meet his eyes. There seemed to be a quiet anger, something just below the skin. Jimmy felt rejected and confused. Sam was his first friend within the group, and for 10 years they had watched Buffalo Bills games together at Jimmy's house in the wood-paneled den with green shag carpeting, a massive white ceramic cross on the wall, and a shelving unit full of Bibles and photo albums and tiny religious trinkets and figurines. During commercial breaks, Sam liked to look through the old photo albums from Jimmy's parents' childhoods in the old country. After a win, they would recreate plays in the backyard, diving around with Jimmy's Nerf football. Sam loved the sandwiches Jimmy's mother made, with oily meats and crusty bread, and he had learned to say please and thank you in Italian. But now, in March of their junior year of high school, Sam wouldn't even look at Jimmy when Jimmy tried to discuss the recent trade of the Bills' second-string quarterback for a hotshot wide receiver from Dallas with well-documented legal troubles. Everyone in the city of Buffalo had their opinion on the trade, yet when Jimmy asked Sam about his, Sam murmured, "Don't know, don't care." Jimmy didn't understand what had gone wrong. He speculated about the possibilities. Sam always liked to be at the center of things, making the loudest jokes, challenging Alice's authority, setting up competitions in areas where he knew he could win.
Jimmy wondered if Sam suddenly felt ashamed that he required Jimmy's help with schoolwork. But what had caused the change? Jimmy tried to ask him indirectly, then directly, and Sam scoffed at him as though he had requested an unreasonable favor. Even though Jimmy did not sense a change in anyone's feelings toward him outside of Sam, he was still afraid to talk about it with any of the others, even Sally, with whom he shared almost everything. He worried that if whatever was bothering Sam were to be aired publicly, the others might come down on Sam's side of things. Jimmy tried to console himself with the idea that the overall group dynamic was becoming more complicated as they grew older, that change was unavoidable. Now there were pimples and breasts and untimely boners. There were Lynn's erratic moods. There were secrets. There was a new intensity to all of them. Life felt shifty. But this was all just part of growing up, Jimmy reasoned with himself. Perhaps he was reading too much into Sam's behavior toward him. Besides, Jimmy had other concerns outside of his friendship with Sam, namely, his own penis. He had a love-hate relationship with the thing. He loved its appearance when hard, the pleasing uniform pinkness of it, the handsome little ring of curled black hair that surrounded its base, the stately stiff ridge, its overall symmetry and its size. It was the right size, a great size, quite frankly. He loved the victory of ejaculation, that staggering psychedelic moment. Oh, but he hated its appearance when soft, a shriveled white acorn. He hated when it betrayed him, stiffening at the wrong times, disobeying strict orders to cease and desist, and for the ultimate betrayal. Jimmy's worst and darkest secret, his penis was entirely to blame. Chapter 14. Sam had been in love with Sally all along. When they were little and before they really even knew each other, he loved and admired her silver hair and her sweet smells. When they grew a bit older, he loved her teeth, the tiny, even spaces between them, her pale eyes, a little pink top she wore. By the time they were 12, he had come to love her legs, as flawless as cream, the earliest suggestion of breasts that rose beneath her shirt, and he loved to make her laugh. Sam had a large rotation of jokes and tricks and funny faces that he employed to entertain Sally. He could make her laugh and laugh until she had to clap a hand over her mouth and wave for air. He loved to make her laugh because as soon as she stopped laughing, her eyes became grave. Sam was convinced that he was the only one who could save Sally from the mysterious sadness that seemed to so easily overtake her. He loved her. He would have traded all the rest of them for her, even Jimmy, his best friend since they were 5 years old. He would have traded his own siblings for her, his own mother. Sam felt certain that Sally loved him, too. But he worried that she would reject him if she thought a romantic union might isolate the two of them from the other gunners. Sally had a mild and agreeable personality. She always wanted everyone to get along, everything to be fair. So, for Sally's sake, Sam waited. He watched her go from a little girl to a young woman, and his desire for her intensified. Sam started saving money to buy Sally a ring to give to her for her 16th birthday. He knew she wouldn't marry him at this young age, but he was ready to express his love to her. They were hurtling through adolescence, juniors in high school now, and he had watched serious and lasting romances form between classmates at school. He knew that if he waited too long, he would lose Sally to someone else. He had convinced himself that the rest of the gunners would understand. Maybe they would even be happy for the two of them. Sam pruned his grandmother's shrubs and collected recyclables from street trash, which were worth 5 cents apiece if he took them to the center. He had his eye on a little gold ring with an emerald heart that he had seen at J.C. Penney's.
Green was Sally's favorite color. Sam worked and saved and worked and saved and finally earned the $58 needed to purchase the ring. It came in a beautiful red velvet box that was as soft and warm as a baby animal. During the days leading up to Sally's birthday, Sam made plans to meet up with her on the evening of her birthday after dinner time. He'd had almost no contact with Sally's mother over the years. It seemed almost like an unspoken rule, but approaching Sally at her home was the only way he could avoid encountering any of the other gunners who might interfere with the plan. The plan was this. He would go to Sally's home and ask if he could take her on a walk. He would say he'd gotten something for her birthday. They would go to the park on James Street. The park wasn't much to see. Splintered fencing covered in graffiti, a tilted merry-go-round, sun-faded swings on a squealing iron frame. But it was the nicest outdoor location he could think of. He would tell her of his great love. She would be stunned, but overjoyed. She would put the ring on. The two of them would make a plan to tell the rest of the gunners so that they wouldn't have to hide their relationship. He would maybe, and probably even, kiss her. The evening of Sally's birthday finally arrived. Sam combed his hair and stuffed himself into his slimmest pants. He admired the ring, put the box in his pocket, and at 8 o'clock, he left his home and walked up Ingram, his pulse beating against his skull. At Sally's home, Sam rang the doorbell, but there was no answer. He rang it a second time, then a third. He knocked on the door, thinking that perhaps the bell was broken. Was no one home? Earlier in the day, when he had casually asked Sally if she had plans for her birthday, she had said that she did not and would probably just be around. Sam turned back toward the street and noticed now that Sally's mother's Cutlass Supreme was not parked out front. Perhaps she had taken Sally out for dinner. But the lights were on. Corinne was probably working late or with a boyfriend, Sam thought. And Sally was probably in there alone, wishing she had someone to spend her birthday evening with. Although he'd never once set foot inside the home, Sam knew which side of the home Sally's bedroom was on. He decided to make his way around to that side, to see if perhaps she was listening to music or watching TV, which had prevented her from hearing the doorbell. Sam felt a little squirrely about sneaking around their property and snooping on her bedroom this way, but if Sally was in there by herself, well, it could be perfect and romantic, couldn't it? Like a movie. The one with the guy holding the handwritten sign professing his love outside the girl's house, although now Sam couldn't remember how things had turned out for that guy and his handwritten sign. Sam made his way around the home, and the light in Sally's room was off. He was about to head back to his own home and formulate a new plan for tomorrow, when a bit of movement from inside the bedroom caught his eye. Sam returned to the window. And it was dark in there, but he could see now that there was someone inside. He could see the back of Sally's head, and the rest of her was beneath the covers. And what? There were two bodies. Sally was on top. There were hands on Sally's head, behind her neck, and beneath the covers. There were rhythms. No. Sam felt like his knees were bending the wrong way. He felt like time did not exist. Sam's impulse to continue watching, to find out who, and to break into the house and strangle whoever had taken this from him, was overtaken by a swell of nausea and the impulse to get as far from this scene as he could. He ran back to the street and made his way up Ingram unevenly, loping up the street like an injured animal, face wet with tears and twisted with rage. Not back to his home where he might encounter his mother and have to explain himself, but instead
to the gunner house. It was dark and empty, and when Sam entered, he didn't turn on the light, but pulled the door shut behind him. He drew the ring from his pocket and threw the little red velvet box across the room and let out a painful scream. The room smelled exactly the same way it always smelled, and Sam wept.
Who?
He lay back on the mattress and closed his eyes. It had to be one of them. Sam had been watching Sally long enough to know that she didn't have friends outside of the Gunners. She didn't talk to any other boys. She didn't even give them looks. It had to be one of them. But which one? Sam's stomach lurched and soured at either possibility. Sally and Mikey had been best friends before the group came together. The two of them sat together on the bus and shared an early bond, both trapped in a home with a sad sack single parent. But Mikey was so small, so shy. He was a year younger, still just a sophomore. He was so innocent. Under the covers with Sally that way? Holding her head and her neck that way? But Jimmy was Sam's best friend. Jimmy. How could he? Sam had never spoken of his feelings for Sally, not even to Jimmy. But how could Jimmy not know? How could Jimmy sneak in and... Oh, it made so much sense, of course. Those turquoise eyes. Sam knew how girls looked at Jimmy. The whiz kid. That stupid tapping code Jimmy had developed that only Sally understood. Jimmy could have been saying anything to her, and no one else would have ever known. Sam's thoughts turned to the morning several months earlier, when he had gotten up at 6 a.m. to take the family dog out. The sun wasn't even fully up yet, and Sam wore boots and a winter coat over his pajamas. He was groggy as he opened the door and trudged up the block with the dog, who always required a brief expedition to locate the perfect pee spot. As Sam passed Jimmy's house, where all the lights were still off, something down by the basement storm window caught his eye. Something had appeared for a split second, as though it were about to emerge from the storm window, but then it had disappeared just as quickly back inside. Sam stared at the storm window. It was a flash of white, something that had been scared off by Sam's presence, and now it was gone, whatever or whoever it was. Sam yawned and continued up the street with the dog. It could have been nothing just as easily as it could have been something. Now, as Sam thought back to that morning, he knew with great certainty that the white flash had been Sally's hair. Sally had spent the night with Jimmy and had been about to sneak out before Jimmy's parents woke, but she had caught sight of Sam a split second before he'd fully caught sight of her. It had to be. And as Sam thought about it more, it was so obvious now that Jimmy had been hiding something for a long time. Little things. Moments when Sam could tell that Jimmy had moderated an impulse before speaking. Withdrawn silences, expressions of guilt. Finally, Sam understood. Who knew how many nights Jimmy and Sally had already spent together? Sam couldn't even begin to imagine how long this might have been going on. How many loving and agile sex things had been done in Jimmy's basement and Sally's bedroom. Sam wanted to strangle something with his bare hands, and so he forced himself to stay there in the gunner house, knowing that if he left, he would do some violence. He would ruin his life if he did the things he wanted to do. He counted breaths. He spoke a mantra to himself. You fat, hopeless loser. What did you expect? You fat, hopeless loser. You don't deserve love. You fat, hopeless loser. And although these words did not make Sam feel any better, they transferred some of the anger toward Jimmy onto himself, so that his murderous rage gradually began to subside. He rose from the mattress, punched the wall until his knuckles were mangled and flaked, did push-ups, returned to the mattress,
You fat, hopeless loser.
An hour later, Sam was startled by someone entering the front door of the gunner house. He lurched upright as the figure stood in the doorway lit from behind by the streetlight. Alice seemed equally spooked by Sam's presence in the dark room. She said, "Who's there? Scared the crap out of me." Sam said, "It's me." Alice entered the room and reached up to turn on the light. She was so tall, especially from Sam's seated position. Her dark hair was tied sloppily on top of her head. She wore men's jeans that only reached her ankles, a Buffalo Sabres t-shirt, a pair of lime green Chinese mesh slippers with sequins across the toes. Sam blinked. His face felt as if it were covered in clay.
"What are you doing here?" he said.
"What are you doing here?" Alice said. She pointed toward the far corner of the room. "I left my bio book here last night, and that paper's due Monday."
She examined Sam's face and said, "Dude, you look like you just fought a war. What is up?"
Sam's fingers went to his face. He felt wrecked and wronged. His heart, it actually hurt. And while he hated the idea of displaying vulnerability in front of Alice, who at times over the years he had hated more intensely than he'd hated all of the rest of them combined, he also trusted Alice and longed to confide in someone. Sam said, "Sally's with somebody." Alice frowned.
"What?"
"She's with somebody."
"With somebody?"
Alice said.
"What? Who? How do you mean?"
She studied Sam's face for a moment with her black eyes and then said,
"You're in love with her."
"No," Sam snapped. Alice sat down next to Sam on the mattress.
"Why do you think she's with somebody?"
"I went over there earlier just to see how her birthday was. I saw through her window. She was in her bed, and there was someone else in there, too."
Alice said, "Who?"
Sam shook his head.
"I couldn't see. But it's gotta be one of them. It's gotta be Mikey or Jimmy."
When she didn't respond, Sam turned to face her straight on.
"Alice," he said, "it's got to be Jimmy."
Alice was quiet for a little while. Surprised that Alice didn't seem to share his indignation, and deeply irritated by this, Sam said,
"Can you believe it? This sneaking around? These are supposed to be our friends."
Sam watched Alice's face. Her expression remained calm, but flickered through a small series of thoughts that he couldn't follow. Finally, Alice said,
"We're in high school now. Things are changing. We're not kids anymore. Things are gonna happen. If Sally and whoever she was with don't want to share anything about their relationship, that's their business. So you should probably get used to it. Because if we're all going to stay friends, we just need to accept that things are going to change."
Sam stared at her.
"You aren't pissed?"
Alice said, "It was only a matter of time." The two of them sat in silence for a while longer. Sam gazed around the dark room, taking in all of its details. Then he lost himself to memories of it, of times when things were not hard and not complicated, when there weren't lies and secrets, when you couldn't stay mad. Laughter, sweat, grass-stained knees, all the hours the six children had shared here, where they were protected by one another and this space from their parents and the outside world. Alice was right. Things had changed. This place was no longer safe and happy. These people could no longer be trusted. Sam felt a dark creature coming to life, sniffing the air inside himself.
Finally, Alice said, I need to get some work done on that paper.